Welcome to the Luciferian Research Society podcast. I'm your host, Jeremy Crow, and you're listening to the third episode. This episode is about dream work, lucid dreaming, and astral projection, or the out-of-body experiences. First, we'll define some terms, and then we'll go over techniques. We'll also be including some examples of profound dreams. Special guest interview with Edward O'Toole. We've got some submissions from members of the LRS, and we have two songs for you.
Relax. Relax.
Let's start this by defining some terms. To really understand dreaming experience, we need to understand waking experience first. When you're awake, you're experiencing the world through your senses. Your sense organs pick up information about the world, say for example light enters the eye. A specific range of frequencies and intensities will stimulate the rods and cones of your eye, which will fire and give off an electrochemical signal which gets sent to the brain. The brain then takes this raw data and generates a holographic projection that your consciousness experiences. This is what I call the hologram. It's the multi-sensory experience that your brain generates based off of the sensory inputs. Now, it's not actually what's out there, it's just what you're experiencing. It's all being generated in your brain. There is something out there, but we can't experience it directly. We only experience a model of it in our subjective universe. Our subjective universe is just a model of the objective universe, a personal model that our own individuality creates. When you go to sleep and you dream, this same hologram generator is operating, but instead of focusing on sensory inputs, it takes the information from something internal, your memories, your emotions, the things that are going on inside you. That's why sometimes you'll have a dream and you'll say, wow, that was so real. It just felt exactly like when I'm awake. It's because it's the same function of the brain that creates that multi-sensory experience when you're awake as when you're in a dream. It operates a little bit differently though, because in one sense it's based off of, mostly off of the objective universe, and it's making a model of that, whereas when you're dreaming, you're experiencing a fully subjective universe being generated by this hologram generator in your brain. Now, when you're in deep dreamless sleep, that hologram generator isn't working. That experience generator doesn't function. There is still some level of consciousness there, but we're not accustomed to experiencing self-awareness while without that experience generator running. So most of the time we're not conscious at all during non-dream deep sleep, although there are some traditions that do insist that it is possible to attain that level of consciousness during non-dream sleep. Now, to get into dream work, the first thing that we have to talk about is keeping a dream journal. The dream journal is something that is highly valued in a lot of different cultures, and not just keeping the dream journal, but also sharing your dream with others. In our culture today, we're often told, oh, it's just a dream, it doesn't mean anything. And a lot of people don't even remember any of their dreams. One thing that is important to do if you don't remember your dreams and you want to, is to try and make dreaming an important thing in your daily waking life. And one thing that really helps with this is by keeping a dream journal. It improves your dream recall because it does send a message to your brain that remembering dreams is important if you're keeping a written record of it. Another great benefit of keeping a dream journal is that you can go through it and see if there's any patterns. For example, in my dreams, I often find that there's something bright or unusual in the sky, like some really crazy fireworks, or two moons, or UFOs, flying saucers. Now, these are things that are unusual happenings, but for some reason in the dream, most of the time I look at that and I just accept it as real. I don't question whether or not it's a dream, but when I noticed that I was having this same type of thing happen in a lot of my dreams, I programmed myself to, anytime I saw something strange in the sky, to immediately think, well, am I dreaming? And do a test just to see if I am dreaming. There are a couple ways of testing your state, which we'll get into a bit later. But again, if I hadn't kept the dream journal, I may not have recognized that pattern in my dreams. And now that I have recognized it, sometimes I have been able to recognize, oh yeah, this is a dream. And then the dream is what we call a lucid dream, where you're aware that you're dreaming while still in the dream. And then that usually you have some level of control over at least your own actions. You're not swept up into the current of whatever is happening in the dream. You actually can direct your own actions more like when you're awake. Now, the other thing that you can do with keeping a dream journal, obviously, is to go back and interpret your dreams. Now, back to state testing. This is when you consciously decide to determine whether you're awake or dreaming. One really popular method of doing a state test is to try and read a piece of text twice, like a sign, anything like if you have a book in front of you or text on a screen or even a digital watch. You look at it, read it, look away, look back, and try and read it again. And if it's different, there's a really good chance that you're dreaming. Sometimes you can't even read it in the first place because it just keeps shifting in front of your eyes. For some reason, text and digital watches in dreams are very unstable. And this is something that's common for most people. Sometimes you will get the rare event where you can actually read something. Some people have even reported reading entire books in dreams. In Tibetan Buddhism, there is a tradition of regaining lost treasures that were placed in some sort of heaven, and through lucid dreaming you could sometimes regain these treasures, which were teachings, and they would read it and then they would write it out when they woke up upon memory. This is an unusual case. In most cases, it's very difficult to read any kind of text in a dream. Now, in order to get yourself to do the test properly, you have to actually really truly believe that it's possible that you might be dreaming at any given moment. If you've done this enough times, you'll start doing it in the dream itself, because what you do in a dream is usually your habitual actions and reactions. If you make state testing a habit, you'll start doing it in your dreams as well. The first few times that I did a state test within a dream, I was convinced that I was awake. And when I woke up, I thought, wow, that is really, really convincing. It was incredibly convincing. And until you've experienced that a few times, sometimes it's really difficult to get into that state of mind where you can actually believe that maybe I am dreaming right now. But once you've had that experience once or twice, then it gets a little bit easier. So sincerity in the state testing is important, but you know, with practice and experience, that gets better. Another way that you can increase the level of awareness within a dream and make it more likely that you'll have a lucid dream, become aware that you're dreaming, is to contemplate the dreamlike nature of waking experience. Another version of this practice is to go around during your daily life and interpret everything that you're experiencing as though it were happening in a dream. For example, all of the people that you interact with, imagine them as being a personified part of yourself, an aspect of your own personality, like a dream character, and try and figure out what that person represents within you yourself, and the actions that you take regarding that person, what does that tell you about what's happening within yourself? Eventually, again, as you practice this, it becomes habit, and you eventually start doing it in a dream. This increases the likelihood of you realizing that you are dreaming. This is a lucid dream. When you are in the dream, you know that you're dreaming, and you can exert some level of control over how the dream turns out. At the very least, you can control your own actions rather than being swept up in the tide of whatever is happening in the dream. The first few times that I experienced lucid dreaming, the second that I realized that I was dreaming, I got really excited and I woke up. It was really frustrating because it takes a lot of work to get into that state, aside from the few times that it happened by accident, just randomly growing up here and there. Once I started trying to do it intentionally, as soon as I realized that I was dreaming, I would wake up. There's a very simple technique that you can use to stay sleeping and dreaming so that you can experience the lucid dream for a longer period of time. The trick is to start spinning immediately as soon as you realize that you're dreaming. Just spin around and around and around in a circle. This increases the level of sensory input that you're experiencing from the dream world, and it helps root you into that experience. Usually you'll spin until the world feels a little bit more stable and it doesn't feel like you're going to wake up anymore. Then you go about and do whatever you'd like in the lucid dream. Usually when people first start having lucid dreams regularly, they'll use them for wish fulfillment, and that's fine. For example, people like to fly a lot in dreams, and there's also a lot of sex dreams that people will have in lucid dream states. Eventually, people will start to get a little bit more curious about the dream state itself, and will start investigating or doing experiments. One of the best things to do is to set your intention. Decide, this is the thing that I'm going to do the very next time that I have a lucid dream. And try and remember that before you go to bed every night. It does help set the intention of having a lucid dream as well by doing that, by setting that goal. Some people will even do ritual or occult practices during the lucid dream state.
Hey, this is okay.
The next thing I want to get into is the out-of-body experience or astral travel. The term astral comes from astrum, which means star in Latin. It just means the abode of the stars or the heavens. It was a way of saying that when you left your body, you would roam among the heavens in your dream body or your astral body. The out-of-body experience is usually related as something that happens without conscious intention. For example, during surgery or during a traumatic accident, people will often experience floating outside of their body and experiencing the world from a different point of view. In my personal experience, I found no difference between the astral projection state and the lucid dreaming state whatsoever. They felt and acted and operated in exactly the same way. The only difference is that you're entering the lucid dream state directly from a waking conscious state. Normally, when you have a lucid dream, you fall asleep naturally, you lose your consciousness, images start to arise and form themselves into scenarios which you get drawn into, and there you are in the dream. And you're experiencing the dream when you suddenly realize that it is a dream. That's the normal method for getting into a lucid dream. There are other techniques that you can use to enter into that state directly without having to fall asleep, lose consciousness, and enter a normal dream first. These are the exact same techniques that are considered to be used to produce an astral projection or out-of-body experience. Dr. Stephen LaBarge, in his book Exploring the World of Lucid Dreaming, describes this technique as a WILD, which is an acronym for Wake-Induced Lucid Dream. The basic idea of all of these different techniques for astral projection is to relax your body very deeply, usually lying in bed or in a chair, but very, very relaxed. You then begin imagining a scene, any scene. It could be the room that you're currently in, or it could be somewhere else entirely, but it should be somewhere that you're very familiar with. Imagine it as if you were walking through it in your body. If you move your hand out in front of you, you see your hand. If you place it down on an object, you feel the heat or coldness of the object and its texture. Go around, knock something to hear the sound that it makes. View from the eyes of your body. View exactly like you would view it if you were looking around and moving your head. Feel the weight of the clothes on your body. Feel your weight on the floor. Imagine that there's a piece of food and taste it, smell it. The idea is to engage all of the different senses of this imagined body that you're experiencing this imagined scene through. Eventually you get to the point where you're imagining this so intensely and you're getting yourself into it so much that suddenly your consciousness will transfer over into that imagined body. Suddenly, you'll find yourself standing there where you were imagining yourself to stand. At this point, you will have transferred over into the astral body, or the dream body, and you will be in the lucid dream state, directly from a conscious waking state. This is the true meaning of astral projection. And so that's the end of this section. If you'd like to discuss any of these topics or debate any of the opinions with me, just come to the LRS and join the Astral Projection and Dreamwork group. As always, you can find us at luciferianresearch.org.
You should see him. He's gotten worse. He's somebody I don't know anymore.
There's one dream that I had that had a really profound impact on me. I was sitting there having a conversation with a friend. He was sitting across from me. And I suddenly realized that I was dreaming. Next time I talked, I said to him, "Did you know that this is a dream?" He sat there for a moment and thought, and then said, "Well, if this is a dream, is this your dream? Or is this my dream?" And I was really surprised by that. This is a dream character saying it to me. So I thought, well, of course this is my dream. But then he really seemed like he was a separate consciousness. Like it really seemed that he was an independent being. And I was really confused, and I just thought, I don't know. And so I just kind of reached out for an answer. I was like, I need an answer. I want an answer. And I got this click. It was like an epiphany. And I realized the answer. And I said to him, "If this is a dream, it's just as much your dream as it is my dream, because you and I are one." He thought about it for a minute. And then I saw the look in his eyes, and he realized what I meant. And suddenly, our consciousness united, and I could see in a panoramic from the eyes of both characters, that the character that I was originally playing in the beginning and the other character that I was having the conversation with, I was conscious of both at the same time. And I woke up in that state, and all day when I walked around that day, I thought of how everybody that I'm encountering, in a very real sense, each of them is an aspect of me, and I'm only part of a bigger whole as well. It really did change a lot about how I view the world, both waking and dreaming experience.
I can do anything I put my mind on.
I had this one lucid dream where I was flying around in the sky doing all these spins and things like that, and I'd flown so many times in the dream, I was actually starting to get a little bit bored of it. I looked down at the ground and I thought, you know, the dream Earth would be just as easy to fly through as the dream sky, because they're both made out of mind stuff. And so I decided to just dive bomb the ground, and I flew right at it, and I went straight through into the Earth. And it was cool, it worked. But, and I didn't feel any kind of resistance at all. The only problem was that I couldn't see anything. There was no light down there. So I was flying around, and it was kind of even less fun than flying in the sky, because all I got was the physical sensations of flying around, and I couldn't get back up for some reason. I tried to visualize anything else, a light or a way back up, but it just wasn't showing up in the dream for some reason. So I just eventually just kind of let myself wake up, and I woke up.
Come again.
At the opening of this show, you heard Mad Box by Popeye X, a member of the LRS. We have a link to his MySpace page on the enhanced version of the podcast. And this is his song, Holy Cow. I'm not afraid to
loved by his friends, respected and feared by his enemies, a man of countless virtues.
So we have Edward O'Toole today for an interview as a featured guest. He is the founder of Aesthetica, and he's an author of several books. He also has come out with a tarot deck. Now, Edward, can you tell me a little bit about how you came to be on the path that you are on and what that path is?
How I came to the path that I'm on?
Yes.
I suppose natural progression. I think any occultist follows lots of paths throughout their lives. And, ultimately find one which fits the self, or which fits closest to the self. I don't think there is any distinct path unless you join a cult and accept a specific doctrine or dogma. To say I follow one path and give it a term would be very, very hard to actually say which path it is. The closest I can come up with, I call it Bestian Gnosticism, which I suppose stems from Luciferian Gnosticism, which has developed into Zen Gnosticism.
And that's the concept that you developed through the three books of Aesthetica?
The books are a means of basically removing one's conditional sort of cultural programming. Sophia Bestia sort of breaks the old programming or exposes the old programming. Grimoire Bestia is a means of developing the self out of this programming, and Zen Gnosticism is a means of enabling oneself to find one's own path. The vast majority of people I interact with were born in Western civilization, which is a Judeo-Christian doctrine. Until one really understands that doctrine, not the Bible, but every aspect of our speech, our education system, and realizes how much it has affected us, we can't develop anything toward individuality. That's the principal aim of Sophia Bestia.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that concept. It's something that I've thought about a lot as well.
One thing I really dislike is this sort of pop concept where people turn themselves, especially, for example, Wiccans, as if they've been handed down something from the ages and it's an ancient family tradition. And this is bollocks. For the last 1,500 years, our civilization has been dominated by Judeo-Christian concepts. We didn't grow up in a pagan society. We didn't grow up in a polytheistic society. We didn't grow up under an Asian society. And really, it's until you know thine enemy, you can't break free from this programming. It's a big shock for people. It really is.
Now, I know that one of the rituals that you've written that's gotten a lot of popularity is the Rite of the Unpardonable Sin.
The Unpardonable Sin, yeah?
Can you explain a little bit about the purpose of that ritual?
The Unpardonable Sin, I remember reading about it many years ago, and it intrigued me. And it took quite a while to work out which part of the Bible it was referring to, and then what it exactly entailed. For example, murder is forgivable, sacrilege is forgivable. You could go to church and piss on the floor, it's forgivable. But this concept of utter sort of rejection of the Holy Spirit, this insulting of the Holy Spirit, And this really made me think, why would the Holy Spirit be so integral to Judeo-Christian, I believe, or sort of Christian belief? The Holy Spirit is irrelevant in Judaism. And why did this control us so much? Why would there be such pressure placed on obedience to the Holy Spirit or acceptance of it? It's a means of control, fear, this fear that once you have removed or once you have committed this final unpardonable sin, there is no heaven for you. You are rejected by Jesus, you're rejected by God, you're on your own. And I think it's very similar to being, for example, a heroin or cocaine addict. Until you utterly reject your drug, I mean, totally stop using it, you can't have any freedom from this addiction. It's the same with the unpardonable sin. Until you finally put your stamp on the belief that there will be a heaven, there will be a forgiveness, even if it means purgatory or whatever, you can't be free. And this is a means of saying, I am free. I will accept the consequences on my own merit.
What is the development of your ideas within the Zen Gnosis book?
Well, I think ultimately, if you follow any form of Gnostic path, there comes to a stage which in Grimoire Bestiaire I call penultimate Gnosis. The overriding Gnostic concept of the soul and the body is that the soul cannot be pure while it is incarcerated inside physical form, inside matter. Therefore, the only means of releasing it is through death, which is not a good thing if you're enjoying living. Zen is the natural progression of this, whereby one becomes like the Buddha's middle way, the middle path, where one attempts to live within this reality, physical reality, or what the Gnostics would term as false reality, but one develops this sense of not living or not doing, this wu wei. For me, it was purely a natural progression. I think anybody who's ever followed a left-hand path, specifically Satanism, they reach a point, the antithesis of the Gnostic viewpoint, where they become self-obsessed. It's egoism, narcissism, hedonism, and there are points you reach where this becomes self-negating. In order to live a personally hedonistic lifestyle, you start hurting the people you love because you can only do what you feel you wish to do. Morality goes out the window. So one must find a balance, not in a Christian term, but in a term where, in a sense where one may live in this reality and not be part of it, helps at all.
Okay. Yeah, like in the world but not of it?
Yeah, to use a cliche, yeah. But at the same time, to very live in this world. I reject the concept of escapism. I dislike immensely the idea of sitting on top of a mountain and eating a grain of rice a day. We live here, we're born here. I do believe that we should enjoy it.
Okay.
And Zen Gnosis is what I believe a combination, a culmination of these concepts. Everything from Buddhism to Satanism.
I'm afraid I don't follow you, sir.
You better not. I don't like being followed.
Now, can you tell us a little bit about your experience creating the tarot deck?
Well, to sum up the experience creating a tarot deck, I believe tarot is individual. I believe if you're an occultist, you should have your own tarot. It seems illogical to be using, for example, the Rider-Waite, or even the Thoth. This was Crowley's idea. This is something Crowley came up with, and I'm not Crowley, you're not Crowley, so right. Why are you using his ideas? Surely you should be using your own. And for me, I'm obviously a very big Jungian, and I liked the application of the unconscious in tarot imagery. It made it a lot more logical for me to be able to read my own cards using imagery that I can understand, that I feel comfortable using, or I have experience using. Unfortunately, it's not really accepted by the major tarot producers. They're not fans of left-hand path decks. Shame I didn't make a Twilight pack. That'd be successful. But I'm very lucky, both in the tarot and in Zen-Gnosis. I worked with Eris X, she's absolutely amazing hermetic sigil artist, and she really came up with the concept of the imagery. She meditated on each of my philosophical concepts and constructed sigils dependent on those. To set her artistry in Zen-Gnosis as well for different beliefs, different paradigms, different philosophies, exposing that. Amazing artist.
Yeah, I've definitely checked out some of her art, and I really enjoy it as well.
She's very dedicated. Very, very dedicated.
Was there anything else that you wanted to mention?
There was actually. It's something that I noticed on the Luciferian Research Society. This discussion, what's the difference between Luciferianism and Satanism? This is a question I've heard asked many, many times over the years, and normally the answers are atrocious. if you have time, I'd like to explain the difference by pointing out to your listeners two basic symbols of Luciferianism, or three basic symbols: the serpent, Prometheus, and Jesus, the Christos. The serpent, what does he give? What does he do?
Gives the knowledge.
Yeah, to whom?
Eve.
Well, he gave it to Eve, being the mother of man. The serpent gave us knowledge. He gave us wisdom to know, to be our God, to know our God. And he was punished for it. Prometheus, he gave man fire, and he was punished for it. The Christos gave us means of salvation, and he was punished for it. Mm-hmm. The principal point I'm trying to make is Luciferianism is based on the concept of benefiting mankind, advancing mankind. It's very different to a satanic concept, which is basically an egoistical, a self-obsessed concept, which is benefiting the self. And that is a huge difference between the two paradigms. Also, you have the concept of the afterlife, the Satan of not showing you the same ideas. There's one brilliant example for me of a Luciferian, and that's Beethoven. Beethoven was an arrogant, cantankerous bastard who hated people on an individual basis, but he spent his entire life with this belief in the brotherhood of man, for the benefit of mankind. When he used Schiller's Andy Freuder, the Ode to Joy, this was his gift to mankind. And I would like to say to Luciferians, be hedonistic, be narcissistic, be as superior as you want, but ultimately you're supposed to be giving back for the future of mankind. You're supposed to be freeing them of their slavery, their bonds, and giving them something which will advance them.
Great.
Not
yeah.
You know, enjoying yourself for your 20, 10, whatever it is.
Well, it was excellent talking to you today, Edward.
Thanks, man.
I want to thank you for taking the time out of your day to do this interview.
Well, it's actually night here.
Oh, right. It's evening today.
On the other side of the world. Well, good luck with this society. It's something I'm very interested in. I think you're doing an excellent job so far.
Oh, thanks. Really. Yeah, well, thanks for your support.
No, I really hope it works out, you know? We need something like this.
Thanks a lot again. Good night.
Listen, how are you?
Throughout this show, we'll be featuring artwork submitted by Vintage Angel under the artist's name Kissed. We also have an active web link for those of you viewing the enhanced version of the podcast. As always, you can go over to the LRS at luciferianresearch.org if you'd like to interact with the artist. I also wanted to let you know that I updated my webpage. Go to jeremycrow.com and check it out. Here's a song by Matt Carty. thanks for being on the show, Emily. You run a blog at ouroboroselectric.wordpress.com, and we'll include a link to that. And so what's the purpose and inspiration for creating that blog?
Well, I mean, I've had a lot of blogs before, but I didn't really finish any of them. They weren't all occult-oriented. Most of them were personal. But I really wanted to sort of make myself learn about certain topics more in depth. You know, like before, if I saw a topic I didn't know much about it, like hermeticism, I'd like go to the Wikipedia page, check it out, and then I'd be done. But with the blog, you know, I sort of have to look through things a bit more in depth, get a more well-rounded knowledge of things, and then post on it, and then I get feedback. So I'm really sort of using it as a learning tool, almost like making myself do homework.
Okay, cool. So it's like a way of ordering your thoughts and forcing you to do a little bit more in-depth research?
Yeah.
Like that? Okay, cool. Now, some of the topics that you've covered are chaos magic, for example. That was a popular post. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I really enjoyed writing that one. I didn't know anything about chaos magic before I wrote the post. A friend had brought it up. We were talking about things we both wanted to research, and I was like, oh, chaos magic. Like, that sounds like something I would like, but I had no idea about any of the theory behind it or how it was tied to science or anything. So I looked into it, and I've found that I really, really like the theory behind it, and just the idea of using belief as a tool really struck a chord with me. The idea that, you know, you can believe in a certain dogma, you can be Buddhist for like a few months, try it, and if you don't like it, you're allowed to try something else. And I really like that flexibility of kind of checking different things out. And I also like sigils, that kind of magic. It just seemed, it appealed to me because it was so simple. You know, it wasn't a lot of theater. I'm not into that in ritual. You know, the more complicated, if it takes 3 hours, I'm less likely to do it. I liked it. It appealed to kind of a modern lifestyle. I like that about it.
Yeah, I like it too. It's like a meta system where you can incorporate other systems into the same thing.
Right, it's kind of like a broad paradigm, and you can use it in conjunction with any of your other beliefs, even as they change.
Now, you did another one about hermeticism?
I did. That was interesting, because again, you know, I didn't know much about it before I looked into it. But it's amazing, you start to see these things everywhere. My friend of mine and I have come up with a term for it called the popcorn effect, where you know, you learn about something new, and then all of a sudden you see it everywhere. It's in everything you read, and you notice it a lot more. And since I wrote that post on hermeticism, it's been popping up everywhere. I'm actually reading a comic right now called The Invisibles by Grant Morrison, who happens to be a chaos magician, but he quotes the Emerald Tablet a few times in the comic, which I wouldn't have noticed if I hadn't written the blog post.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that's great. Now, I really liked the post that you made when you had the migraine.
Yeah, that was Struggles of Initiation, I think.
Yeah, like...
Yeah, that one. Sorry, I'm looking at my blog right now. That was rough. I was tired. You know, and I read a lot about initiations and how they're supposed to feel and how tough they could be, and it was really hitting me, you know, resonating with me at the time, because it's hard to do, because you're so interested in, you know, this higher level thinking and these high level concepts, and it's so exciting, and you get so into it, and then you're at school or you're at work and you're with people that have no idea what you're talking about, and you can't communicate with them how excited you are, and you can't communicate with them all these theories. And it gets really frustrating, and so I just wrote that at a time where I was sort of grappling with consolidating real life with this. Not real life, but surface life with sort of the deeper stuff.
Yeah, that's great, and I think that came across in the post as well. Now, do you want to finish up by sharing a dream experience you had?
Sure. I actually have tried to lucid dream a few times. I keep a dream journal because I know that's probably the most important thing. And I did the reality checks that you're supposed to do, where you like you look at a digital clock and you look back and see if it says the same time. Different, you're probably dreaming. Or, you know, you look into a mirror, and if your image is normal, you aren't dreaming. Or if you spin around, and when you open your eyes, you're in the same place, you're not dreaming. So I tried all those during the day, sort of like the dream checks, because that's supposed to carry into when you're dreaming. And then you check, and then you know you're dreaming. And I only had success with it once. I was dreaming, I was in some sort of classroom with a few friends, and we were talking, and I was like, wait, we're on like a roof. This isn't normal. I must be dreaming. So I realized this, and I was like, oh wow, I'm dreaming, and I haven't woken up yet, but I know I'm dreaming. So I realized that it worked. But then I tried to manipulate the environment. You know, I tried to fly, and that didn't work. And I couldn't really manipulate the dream. So I got as far as being aware that I was dreaming, but I didn't really make it to that next level.
Oh yeah, well that's great. That's a breakthrough right there, because then you know it's possible. And once you know
it's definitely
possible. Yeah, some people have a hard time understanding how you could be conscious and asleep at the same time. But
you definitely can. Well, I mean, I've gotten astral projection similar, and I've gotten far enough with that to know it's very possible. I've gotten to the point where You're not conscious of your body at all. You can't feel your body, and you're just sort of like this floating mind. So your body's asleep, but your mind's awake.
Well, thanks for being on the show. We really
appreciate... Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we really appreciate you taking the time out of your day for this.
No problem.
It isn't as simple as diagnosing a case of measles.
So that's the show. I hope you enjoyed it. Our next episode will be about tarot and divination. We'd like to hear from some professional tarot readers that are members of the group. We'd also like to hear from non-professional tarot users who wanted to give us an opinion of, say, one of the cards that they feel a special affinity for. I'll be doing a live reading over the phone for the next episode. So if you'd like to be the one receiving the tarot reading, submit your questions. If you're selected, we'll let you know and we'll set up the time that we can do the call. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, subscribe. Visit the LRS at luciferianresearch.org.
Come on. We'll give it to them good.